Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
With questions about birthright citizenship's future in Trump's America, along with conversations about border walls being put up also again in Trump's America, there are many scholars reaching back to antebellum America to help today's citizens be better historically grounded in these conversations. Scholars like University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign English scholar Dr. Derek R. Spires is one of those scholars weighing in. Today on New Books in African American Studies, your host, me, Adam McNeil, will help guide the conversation with Dr. Spires about his brand new book published by our friends at the University of Pennsylvania Press entitled The Practice of Citizenship, Black Politics and Print Culture in the Early United States. Welcome to the show, Dr. Spires. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
Very good. And this is a, you know, I didn't tell you this in the beginning, but you know, this is a new kind of intro that I'm starting out. So you're kind of like a little bit of a guinea pig here today. So glad everything went on as planned. Very good. So thank you for that. But before we get too far, can you talk to us about how you came to this project?
Part of it was just working through the archives, and part of it was kind of wanting to ask basic questions. So when I was reading particularly the state conventions, but also those pieces collected in Dorothy Porter's early Negro writings and elsewhere, like I kept coming across the phrase fellow citizens, citizen, 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 kept popping up all over the place. And I asked a really basic question. What did they mean by calling themselves? By they, I mean, early African Americans mean when they called themselves citizens, because surely they weren't actually citizens. And so I did some basic research, first figuring out what citizenship was before the 14th Amendment, which became a rabbit hole of conflicting state laws, voting rights being unequally distributed, the lack of citizenship being defined in the Constitution. So that was one hand. And then on the other hand, I began to realize that when folks like Frederick Douglass or the delegates at your given state or national convention called themselves citizens, they were legit thinking of themselves as citizens. So what does that then mean for Black folk before the 14th Amendment in the absence of a kind of national consensus on what citizenship means? To call themselves citizens, and with folks like Garnett extending it, what does it mean for them to think of even enslaved folk as citizens? So that's how it started.
Awesome. And you're speaking about these conventions. Can you be specific? What kind of conventions are we talking about here in this particular early American period?
Good question. So one, shout out to the Colored Conventions Project, which is bringing these conventions to accessible attention. But from the 1830s forward, Black collectives on the national and state levels held conventions of colored citizens or national conventions, beginning in 1833 in Philadelphia and working through Reconstruction. And so my own focus was on the state conventions held in New York Ohio and Philadelphia beginning in the 1840s. Often when folks talk about the state and national conventions, until recently, they emphasized the anti-slavery arguments going on in there. But they also tended to look at them as places where Black politics, Black political collectives fractured. So you get the conversation around divisions between Henry Highland Garnett and Frederick Douglass, for instance, centering around the 1843 National Convention. But when you focus more broadly on these conventions, particularly in the state conventions, you see a really cohesive, democratically, deliberatively structured collective, right? And so looking at these conventions allow us to see Black collectives doing political work, interfacing with states, sending petitions and other documents to state houses, sending representatives to state houses in really interesting ways.
And, you shouted out, the Color Conventions Project. You know, that's where I work with Dr. Foreman and the other folks with the Color Conventions team. Shout out Denise, shout out Brandy, shout out Anna and all the crew. Too many to mention at the, for this brief little interview. So shout out to everybody. So before we go to the antebellum era specifically, right, like, 19th century, you start before that. And one of the most fascinating aspects of your book, you talk about this notion of neighborliness. And it's something that I think a lot of folks, as far as thematically, right, I think that theme of neighborliness that you speak about is something important. So can you please speak to the audience about what you mean by neighborliness and how it functions in your text?
Great question. So neighborliness, I think of it as the ethical core of all the other practices I outline in the book. The other practices include political participation, economic citizenship, critique, revolution. But if there's not a sense of collectivity of doing for the other what you would have others do for you, then the other pieces fall apart. And I talk about neighborliness through Absalom Jones and Richard Allen's 1794 Yellow Fever narrative. And I think Jones and Allen, who are both ministers, founders of the Free African Society, Free African Church, which becomes later the AME Church, were really thinking with their contemporaries about what is it that keeps a society, a community together? What is it that keeps people sort of going in the direction of the common good? And in that narrative, even though they don't mention the parable of the Good Samaritan, so one of the sources for neighborliness, they structure that narrative in a way that mirrors the parable of the Good Samaritan, told in multiple places in the New Testament. It's about a man who's injured on the side of the road. The people, the community expects to help him pass him by until a Samaritan who's sort of a person who represents the abject, like sees this person in need of help and reaches out, right? And within the parable, Jesus says that this moment is the core of what the law should do. It's not just a matter of personal morality. I'm a good person or I have pity on someone. It's a matter of principle, and it's the principle that underwrites the law. I show myself to be a good neighbor because I see someone else and I do the neighborly thing. Not out of sympathy, not out of feeling, sometimes despite the way I'm feeling, but because I know it's the principle I should follow. And Jones and Allen follow that sort of principle, and their examples are individuals, but they also scale it up from the individual instance of someone doing the neighborly thing to their institutions, the Free African Church, doing the neighborly thing in this moment of crisis. And then they scale it up even more, I argue, to suggest that the United States as a state has a neighborly responsibility to emancipate enslaved people and to emancipate them under conditions of neighborliness, so that the focus isn't if we emancipate them, then we have to ship them back to Africa, as Jefferson would say, or we have to compensate their enslavers, which is always a bizarre sort of form of logic, but rather emancipate them with the idea that they are citizens, right, already.
That's an interesting connection too, as well, because I'm very much aligned with thinking about what you're talking about as far as Jefferson. What are you talking about, man? On one end you're trying to, emancipate, but then you're trying to send us out because you think that we're going to be too mad to be able to function in this society. Still a little, look, you're right.
And refusing justified anger, right? On the one hand, he argues that Africans don't have the finer sensibilities that Europeans do. And at the same time, he says, well, they'd be justifiably angry.
Mm-hmm. And also that's a form of, showing the inhumanity of Black folks for someone like Jefferson, that they are not allowed to be justifiably angry, right? On one end, what you're talking about is that Jefferson diagnoses that, the anger and the problem is there, but his remedy is much different than what, Allen and Jones and other African Americans, contemporaries, right? Because I think we forget, like, Allen and Jones are contemporaries of Jefferson in the frame of they're, active as he is rising to become president.
Richard Allen lived down the street from Alexander Hamilton. Yeah, he lived down the street from Hamilton. It's not an abstract thing. They likely passed each
other. Now imagine if that was included in Hamilton. What would Hamilton, right? like? What would Hamilton be like if the Black characters, or like the Black adjacent characters, were folks like Jones, or were people like Allen rather? What would the premise of Lin-Manuel Miranda's awesome, performance and awesome play, right? What would that be? What would that do? Which is a interesting question, don't you think?
One of the things, I taught a course on Hamilton last semester, and one of the things we talked about was that the race-conscious casting did good work in terms of visible representation, but it also created a bit of a narrative problem. So, say Hamilton does include Richard Allen, or does include Benjamin Banneker, who wrote a letter to Thomas Jefferson critiquing what he says in Notes on the State of Virginia, and then published that letter in Philadelphia. How then would you mark their Blackness if Jefferson, Washington, and others are played by Black mm-hmm. folk? Right? It's a kind of paradoxical erasure of Blackness, even as it puts Black people on the stage.
Absolutely. And something that you brought up just then was that Banneker publishes letter to Jefferson. And so that publishing goes into my next question of what does, how do African Americans, how do Black folks in this period, how do they meld their politics within Black print culture, and its emergence, right? How does that happen?
The short answer would be something like the same way it happens for everybody mm-hmm. else. A public figure does a thing that upsets you in early America, as now, and what do? You write about it and you publish it in a very public way. And so in that sense, Black print culture functionally does work similar to a larger American culture. The difference is that this larger American print culture at every step attempts to deny the validity of their arguments, attempts to deny their right to be in the space, right? And Banneker is an interesting and fun case about this because he read Jefferson, he wrote to Jefferson when Jefferson was Secretary of State. So it's a letter to Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson, and he quotes from the Declaration of Independence. He uses the neighborliness principle, essentially saying, if you as a revolutionary thought of yourself as politically enslaved, wrote these words, we hold these truths to be self-evident, et cetera, et cetera. Surely you'd want the same for the rest of us, right? Kind of rhetorical question. Jefferson writes back to Banneker, sort of saying, yeah, I'm looking forward to the day we could do something about this. And this kind of bland, royal we, yeah, gee, that's a problem, wish we could do something kind of way. Banneker then publishes his letter to Jefferson, along with Jefferson's response. And not only that, he also publishes it in his almanac for that year. And part of what I'm thinking is that Banneker had a legitimate gripe with Jefferson, but he also used this moment with Jefferson as a springboard for publishing his almanac. So it's kind of a double barrel.
And I think, you know, Banneker is such a interesting figure. I was looking over the Society for the Sheer, you know, the study of early American Republic. I was going through their program for this upcoming summer in Cambridge, Mass. And if I'm not mistaken, there's somebody, I wish I had it handy, but there's somebody who's actually writing about, you know, like there's a panel called like anti-slavery ambivalence, kind of like looking at, you know, to be African-American, does that necessarily make you an abolitionist if you're free at this time? And that's kind of like the tinge of the titles that I'm looking at. And one of them is actually on Benjamin Banneker, speaking to that particular point. And it was just a really interesting tidbit, because thinking about like how important Benjamin Banneker is, and I think you saw on Twitter, I posted something about like there was an episode of Martin where Tommy thinks that he got like, you know, a Benjamin Banneker clock, but now it was a Benjamin Fanneker, and it was like, you know, it's supposed to be worth like all this money. It's one of my favorite episodes. Yeah. And I bring that up because, you know, even in this, you know, late 20th century moment, like people know how important Benjamin Banneker is just off of like name recognition. But, you know, I don't think as many people would know as like how in depth of an intellectual and as a scientist he was. And so I think that was a bit of about your text that made me, you know, signposted that to me to go back and look at Banneker and early African-Americans going at Jefferson.
Yeah. And to your point about, so just because, I guess, to extrapolate from that, just because someone is Black doesn't mean they don't suffer from anti-Black tendencies or breathe the same air. And this is not a knock on Banneker because he's working with the information available, but in his almanac following the 1793 yellow fever epidemic, he actually republishes one of the articles claiming that Black people are sort of inherently immune to the yellow fever, even as Jones and Allen are contesting that. And so they're kind of writing at the same moment, but there's a kind of time lag between the information getting out there.
No, that is true. That is true. And Lord knows you can see that in our culture today. Lord knows. Lord knows. And so with that too, going a little bit further into the antebellum era, can you talk about the rise of Black, not only, you know, you talk about Black print culture, right? That has a much further push, but can you talk about Black publishers and their role in your story too?
Right. It's interesting. So a quick aside, a friend and colleague of mine, Ben Fagan, published a book a couple of years ago, The Black Newspaper and Chosen Nation. Mm-hmm. And I think we've been on parallel tracks since grad school. So I encourage everyone to check that out because he gives really great biographical and analytical sort of discussions of Black publishing. But the thing about Black print, Black activism, is that everything's connected. It's not just I'm going to advocate for X. It's I'm going to advocate for X, and doing that means that I need to think about print, and doing that means that I need to think about the mode of production, right? And so one of the early things you see in the convention movement is conventioneers saying, we need a press. We need our own voices. Our warfare lies in the field of thought. And when they say we need a press, they're not just talking about we need a newspaper. They mean we need to own the means of production, from the AME Church's book concern to Frederick Douglass's real deep concern with the quality of his paper, his type, and ink, etc., to Thomas Hamilton, who is a part of this second or third generation who comes of age knowing that Black newspapers exist. He is working on Black newspapers for the better part of his life. And so it's a package deal. Owning the means of production, making sure that when Black events are happening, there's a venue that gives an impartial account of what's happening in the space, making sure there are venues for discussion, like Frederick Douglass's paper, Anglo-African magazine and Weekly Anglo-African. And then these activists were also concerned with, at least from their perspective, training their readers and people they thought of as their constituents in modes of debate. So we have these print spaces now, right? We have a newspaper, we have a press. How ought we to be engaging with each other in a critical way, but also in a generous and productive way?
Mm-hmm. And one of the actresses in your text that to me embodies many of the principles that you speak about is let me see, you have. Was it Frances Ellen Watkins Harper? Right. I got that before. Getting all of those in place correctly is probably one of the hardest things I've ever, you know, tried to do just like off the top. And so, you know, she's a major function in your text. Can you talk for the listeners who don't know much about her? Can you tell us how important she is tied into your text?
You know, I am a Harper stan these days. She is. And the more I learn about her, the more awesome she is. And I also have to say that my understanding of Harper and my exposure to her comes directly out of the work of Frances Smith Foster, whose Brighter Coming Day was my in, as well as Carla Peterson, Melba Boyce Joy. I'm getting a little tongue tied.
No, that's all good.
Sorry. Carla Peterson, Frances Smith Foster in particular. And so Harper, like one, she works on multiple levels. She is a lecturer, beginning in the 1850s. She's a poet, who sort of begins to write on the national scale. In the 1850s with her poems reflecting on Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin that were published in Frederick Douglass's paper and elsewhere. She's the child of William Watkins Sr., who himself on the school had connections to David Walker. So she's a child of someone who was himself a radical. She advocated for suffrage rights. She wrote some of the earliest short stories by Black women. She wrote some of the earliest novels by African Americans, Black women. She did it all, right? And she did it with a kind of flair, but she did it in the modes that people at all levels could get. So her poems were often in the ballad form. You could sing her poems, right? You could set some of her poems to Greensleeves and sing them. But the content is intellectually rich. She's engaging with Enlightenment and Romantic philosophy. She's engaging with 19th century political thought. She's engaging with her contemporaries. So it's a simple form, but like a really deeply thought out intellectual work happening. You can analogize some of her work to Lemonade, right, in that way. And so when I take her up in the book, I take her up in two places primarily. One, in the context of state conventions where she appears in Ohio and is noted for fundraising. And this is a thing that happened to Black women in the convention movement. More broadly, they're often, their labor isn't recognized officially, except often in fundraising. And what she does later in life is write a sketch lampooning the fact that conventions tend not to recognize women outside of their fundraising work. And then I take her up properly in the last chapter, because I argue she develops a kind of pedagogy of revolutionary citizenship. She says that Black people need to teach their children through the stories of people like Margaret Garner, who in 1856 famously kills her daughter rather than see her return to enslavement, or a revolutionary who participated in a rebellion in Tennessee in 1856, who the story goes died rather than give up some of his co-conspirators. These are the people who need to be sung about. And she writes about this in a sketch series, Fancy Sketches, that's published in the Anglo-African magazine in 1859. And she has a character who, after hearing these stories, says, "What can I do?" Right? She's very moved, as we often are when we encounter something that changes our worldview. And she has another character, Jane, who says, "Well, the first thing you can do is subscribe to the Anglo-African, right? Get the knowledge, support the Black print spaces."
And that's really interesting, because, you know, she, Harper is one of the, you know, working, you know, at the University of Delaware and taking classes from Dr. Foreman. You know, we had you on, you know, when Jessica and I had, you know, we presented on your book, and we had you on, you know, shout out to you, Dr. Foreman, for making that happen. One of the more important parts, right, you talk about the conventions, right? Harper went to many conventions, right? She was a very instrumental figure. You know, her and Marianne Shad Carey, you know, are probably two of the most recognizable women, you know, especially when we start talking about, you know, women's suffrage and you know, just abolitionist thought and just, you know, general convention culture. You know, it, you know, with that being said, did you utilize a lot with your research the project's digital archive?
Increasingly. When I started, my first introduction to the colored conventions is browsing the stacks in the library and seeing these two red volumes, which is Fauner and Walker's collection of the antebellum state conventions, and then seeing Howard Holman Bell's work, collection of the colored conventions, but also his book on the colored conventions movement. And so my awareness of the colored conventions started then, before CCP was up and running. And the two, my research of the conventions mm-hmm. and the CCP archives, have sort of grown together. And it's been great, especially on the back end of finishing the book, where before I'd have to track down newspaper articles, microfilm, used to Black abolitionist papers, which is an awesome resource. The Bell and Fauner and Walker collections. Mm-hmm. By the time I'm finishing the book, I could search the CCP archives. I could reference the fantastic exhibits on there. I actually cite some of the exhibits, and I tried as much as possible when I cited conventions in the book to give both the Fauner and Walker or Bell citation and the CCP citation so people could access them in both formats. I feel like we've grown together in a way.
And it's really cool to really see that, because what it does is, you know, a lot of times people ask, so you know, people publish a book in 2018, 2019. And it's like, you know, one of the questions I typically hear people ask is, you know, do you have a digital component, you know, feature, right? Do you have something like a tag along add-on to the text? And I think that's a really cool thing about, you know, the Color Conventions Project, is that, you know, the question is answered online. And it definitely sounds like you were able to utilize, many of them as well. And so now that we're kind of talking more about process, that's a good way to pivot a little bit. So as you're writing this book, what is your process like as a writer? What's your process like, compiling and organizing? What is that part of the writing process look like for you, Dr. Spires?
It evolved over time. I think one of the things I had to figure out how to do early on and continue to figure out how to do is a good filing system goes a long way. Figuring out the organizational principles that work for a particular project at a particular time with a particular technology. I also think for me, it's always been useful to go, especially as more and more things become digital, to go back to the older interfaces. With newspapers, for instance, I might get a hook. Part of what I did earlier in the process when I have one chapter on James McCune Smith and William J. Wilson, who wrote in Frederick Douglass's paper under the pseudonyms Ethiop and Communipaw. And very early in the process, I was just trying to figure out how many of these Ethiop and Communipaw sketches there were out there in Frederick Douglass's paper, and whether or not they jumped into other publications. And this was just as Accessible Archives was coming online. And one of the things I started to do was just run searches through Accessible Archives for Ethiopian Communipaw. And I was doing that, but also trying to figure out what other resources were out there, and realized that part of what I was doing was reinventing a wheel that someone else had already done. Back in the day, John Blasingame edited a multi-volume index of anti-slavery newspaper writing. Before Accessible Archives, before searchability, there's this index on the bottom shelf of the reference section of the library. I could go to that index, look up James McCune Smith, and get a rough estimate of how many things he published in Frederick Douglass's paper, The Liberator, The National Anti-Slavery Standard, etc. You could do the same thing with the Black abolitionist papers. And so what I had to learn was that my first impulse should not necessarily be the rough search through the digital interface. My first impulse might be looking at the index of the Black abolitionist papers to see what work has already been done, honoring that and lessening some of the frazzled nature of just random searches. All right, so that's one thing I had to do, get the filing system down, but also remember to go back to what's already been done before I turn myself into some sort of errant Columbus figure, discovering stuff all over the place.
Right? Like Taylor Swift last night. And,
yeah.
Oh, my. Yeah, that's a whole nother podcast series right there.
Yeah, different format, different venue.
There we go.
And then carving out writing time. One of the most difficult things I had to learn was developing a consistent writing structure. For me, that means carving out writing time that I treat as if it's a class or a standing meeting that I don't violate. It means writing in sessions with built-in breaks rather than thinking I'm going to write for 4 hours straight. And it means differentiating between kinds of writing. So going in with a game plan that I've already mapped out the day before, saying today I'm going to consolidate and do some preliminary close reading of things I've already found. Or tomorrow, I'm going to focus on ways that I can sort of theorize what's happening, but making sure that before I jump to the theoretical piece, like making sure I understand what folks are trying to do in their writing on their own terms before I then go and try to carve something out of it.
I asked that in part, you know, like I said before, we spoke in Dr. Foreman's CCP class a few weeks ago. But you know, we have a lot of, you know, graduate students. We have a lot of folks not, you know, involved in the history process or the writing process, rather. And such. So I always find it really informative to learn about how different scholars, you know, what's their process like, because to me that then allows folks to better understand where folks are coming from in their texts, and they can kind of see not only the product, right, the book, but also learn a little bit about the actual people that are writing these texts. Because I think a lot of times, like a book, it's personal, right? You read the acknowledgments, you read, you know, the footnotes, that's a form, you know, that citation. That citation is love bit that, you know, folks like Dr. Jessica Marie Johnson down at Johns Hopkins talks about and such, among other scholars. And so I'm glad that I asked that question, because you definitely provided a whole lot of meat that folks hopefully will be able to chow down on as they're trying to finish the semester strong as well.
And I'll say, one of the things one of my advisors said, Teresa Gadu, she said, don't suffer in silence. Like, we put so much pressure on ourselves, also dealing with forms of anxiety, just being Black in this world, imposter syndrome, et cetera, and expectations that, at least for me, tend to suffer in silence without reaching out to people. And for me as a graduate student, that ended up in me hitting a wall and hitting it pretty hard. And so Gadu said, don't suffer in silence. One of my other advisors, Ifeoma Nwankwo, gifted me a subscription to basically a writing support group, which helped me develop healthy writing habits. Like, your advisors, mentors are there to help support you. If you're in a graduate program, ideally, you're there because the people in the program are investing in your life, and they're there to help.
Mm-hmm. And with that too, you know, you spoke about your writing groups and such too. So, on that note, can you talk to us a bit about when you're writing, who are the people? If you're okay answering this, of course, but would you mind speaking a bit about who are your interlocutors as you write, right? Because you know, you have your acknowledgments and such too, but can you speak to, you know, who are the people that, you know, are you know, reading your work, to really acknowledge them in this process too? Because from what it sounds like, you know, you have a team of folks who are very important to your writing process.
Yeah, it's a team of folks. A shout out to conferences and conferencing, because every time I go to a conference, it's like a collective of people feeding into a spirit. And I hesitate to name names, not because I don't want to name names and honor people, but because I'm afraid of missing somebody.
Understood.
So I'll name a few. The Unit for Criticism here does a manuscript workshop. And so some of the folks who participated in that, who read the manuscript before it went out to press, Susan Koshy, who's done a great job directing the unit, John Ernest, who you know, and whose work both freaked me out because I read it at a time when I was trying to write on some of the texts he wrote about, but also helped model things for me. Ivy Wilson, similarly, Justine Morrison, my hallmate and colleague here at Illinois, Carla Peterson, Gabrielle Foreman, Chris Freeberg, who I have to credit with helping develop the title for the book, my colleague Lindsay Rose Russell here. And see, now I'm starting to get in trouble because I could just keep naming names and I don't want to leave anybody out. My wife, Nafisa Thompson Spires, we talk things through a lot. And some of it isn't necessarily people who read things per se, but people who I can just talk about stuff with. listening to your podcast, for instance.
Hey, I like that.
Helps me think through ideas, even though I'm not necessarily in direct conversation with the people you bring on. So, yeah.
And for the listeners, hey, you know, this is a great transition to just say, go buy the book, right? Go out, you know, support University of Pennsylvania Press, Penn Press, because, you know, the practice of citizenship, Black politics and print culture in the early United States, written by our friend of the podcast, Dr. Derek R. Spires, right? Go out and get that book, because then, right, you'll be able to go read the acknowledgments to then be able to see the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say back on, you know, when he was in his NPR days, you know, shout out to him. And so, yeah, because honestly, like when people think about like where my love of radio and podcasting really comes from, it's from talking about attributions. My mother always picking us up, you know, around that like 5 o'clock hour, and Paul Harvey's voice, the rest of the story. Like literally that is a part of my life. And so it made me really want to kind of like engage in radio because, you know, I talk all the time, so might as well like, you know, make it work. Right. And with that being said, so in the short amount of time that we have left, can you talk to us a bit about, you know, the book is out and, you know, it's out to the world and, you know, and I saw you at a recent conference here at the University of Delaware, Black Bibliographia. Shout out to Dr. Laura Hilton, as well for that, for creating that process, along with Dr. Jesse Peterson, Erickson, rather, and Dr. Curtis Small, as well. And so, shout out to them. But can you talk to us a bit about, you know, what's next if you're working on another project or something else within CCP?
What's next? Part of what's next is the interest I have in seriality and figuring out why Black writers turn to serial publication so often in the 19th century in ways that I think differs from their white counterparts, but also thinking about how to understand their understandings of Blackness. And I think seriality has become a key word for me. I tend to like to think in terms of keywords. So right now, seriality is it. The sketch is another one for me, trying to figure out what's going on with this genre that's so capacious. And one of the people I'm interested in right now, aside from Frances Harper, is her sort of partner in crime, William Steele. So thinking about the Underground Railroad as a curated document, how do we understand this really understudied, monumental, as in 800 plus pages book published first in 1872.
That is tremendous. That is tremendous because I think maybe not first, but one of the early times that I got to learn about William Steele was actually through a theatrical performance during WGN America's Underground. Because, you know, he was a major part of the show. And, you know, that was, I think, back in 2015, 2016. Shout out to you, John Legend. He needs to come back on the television. But that show provided me, you know, a space to say, like, dang, this dude is really doing a whole lot of stuff. So it's really awesome to hear that you are taking up Harper more, but then also going and working within the still, you know, massive archive, right? Because, you know, effectively, you could say, like, you know, that 800-pound, it probably weighs that much, but an 800-page document, you know, that's a big archival document, man. So it's definitely, you know, got to take your time with that, no?
Yeah, and it's an archival document, but it's also like a curated thing, still organized it. He intersperses narrative. He creates drama and tension in the way he collects the documents. So understanding it as both an archive, but also in its own way, like a show, right? Because each letter, each narrative sketch, each arc, it's its own plot line. And all of these plots sort of connect in ways because they all come through Steele's, they're all interlocutors with Steele, who's sort of at the center of this hub, right? So how do we understand this as both archive and as creative work? Mm.
And one last question, if I may, we got a couple more minutes left. I have one question, because one of the things that was the most fascinating about the talk that you gave in our class, it seems that the writing process and there's the overall sense of your work, that there's like it feels like there's a spiritual connection that you kind of have to the work. And it's it's very fascinating. So talk a bit about, you know, kind of how your writing is a bit, you know, that there's a spiritual element too, as well.
Yeah. Full disclosure, I grew up Baptist. and that is still with me in all sorts of ways. I'm just coming to terms with, and many of them good. I identify as Christian. This is part of my makeup. It comes with its own ethics. And so some of it comes out in what I notice in the writing. I notice reference to the parable of the Good Samaritan in Jones and Allen's narrative, because I grew up getting that story at least once a year in Sunday school. Mm-hmm. So how could I not recognize it? But it also, I think, attunes me to some of the theologically informed ethics that all of these writers are working with, because they're similarly coming out of churched in one way or another backgrounds and doing amazing things with this work. From Harper, who becomes Unitarian later in life, to Douglas, who has a vexed relationship with organized religion. Right? So that's one piece of it. And like the neighborliness that we started out the conversation with, it's also how I like to live my life. Like doing unto others as I'd have them do unto me, seeing others as neighbors, approaching the stranger as a neighbor and making neighborhood. So that's one piece of it. The other piece of it is like these writers doing this work feeds my spirit. It keeps me out of pessimism. It keeps me hopeful in ways that aren't pie in the sky, sort of non-realist hope, but a kind of practical optimism. I think that's something that Harper is really great at. And so the running joke between me and Nafisa, my partner, is that for everything that happens in the 21st century, I got a quote from someone in the 19th or 18th century. Whether it's James McCune Smith, Douglas Harper, Mary Shad Carey, somebody, they've gone through it. They've seen it. And then the third thing I'd say is I feel a sense of mm-hmm. responsibility to these people, because your relationship to the work changes. Your relationship to thinking about what was possible back in the day changes the minute you mm-hmm. remember that these are people, right? With feelings, with emotions, with drives, et cetera. And I feel an immense sense of responsibility to get the story right and to get out of the way, because what they're doing is so rich that part of what I wanted to do with the practice of citizenship is just say, here, look, see, pay attention. They're still with us. They're still doing work. We just need to pay attention.
And for the last pretty much 48 minutes, we've had a captive audience that you've been able to talk to about your work. And, you know, Dr. Spires, it has been a pleasure and an honor to finally make this happen. Dr. Foreman, you know, when she was compiling the class and such, and we got a kind of insight about whose books we're going to be reading for the semester. And I saw that your book was out, and then I also looked on the Penn Press website too. And I was like, I read the description. I was like, whoa, man, this thing's about to be a banger, man. It's about to be a game changer out here. And, after talking for pretty much like the last 49 minutes and the various other conversations over the course of the last 5 to 6 months, it has just been a pleasure and an honor. And once again, folks, we have had the honor of having Dr. Derek R. Spires, who is Associate Professor of English at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, who has been on to talk about his brand new published book by our friends at Penn Press. Shout out to them. It's called The Practice of Citizenship, Black Politics, and Print Culture in the Early United States. And folks, I am your host, Adam McNeil. I love doing this. I love talking to y'all. Next time, it's going to be another good one. Over and out.